Hello and welcome to another episode of the Investors Chronicle Extraction podcast, in which we speak to executives of London's natural resources companies. I'm Alex Newman, a writer at the Investors Chronicle, and today I'm joined by Paul Atherley, Chief Executive and MD of Berkeley Energia, owner and developer of the Salamanca Uranium Project in Western Spain, which recently made the step up from AIM to London's main market. So Paul, thanks.
My pleasure, Alex. Nice
for joining
here.
Us today. Could you just please start? I'm assuming no prior knowledge on behalf of our listeners. Can I just start by asking you to give our listeners a quick overview of the Salamanca project, its economics, and where you currently are with the development?
Berkeley Energia owns the Salamanca mine in Western Spain. We own it 100%, as you've indicated. It's the only uranium mine being built in the world today. In fact, what we're trying to do is pour concrete at the bottom of the cycle. So here we are with uranium prices around $20 a pound. Most analysts are talking it's a $40, $50, $60 a pound. So we're doing that thing that most junior companies never do, is we're raising money, we're fully financed. We've just done $120 million financing with the Oman Sovereign Wealth Fund. We're just on the point now of literally pouring concrete and steelwork coming out of the ground. So we could be that very rare animal that pours the concrete, builds the assets at the right point in the cycle.
Excellent. And in terms of the development itself, when are we expecting first uranium from the mine?
The guidance we're giving is that we will commence construction in September. It's a 12-month build, first uranium towards the end of 2019, and then 6 months to full ramp up by the middle of 2020.
Excellent. So we can come on to talk a bit about the uranium market, I hope. Just first, I just wanted to touch on, you know, the recent development being your step up to the main market. Why did you decide to do that?
Two reasons. One is a different group of shareholders on the main market. We've been extremely successful with generalists. Although we're an AIM-listed stock, our register is full of blue-chip institutions. So clearly they are more populous on the main board. So it gave us that. And the second reason was we are passporting across to list on the Spanish Stock Exchange. And we're expecting to list the 18th of July. And what's unique about that is, although Spain is arguably the origins of modern mining, Rio Tinto's fabulous mine there. And it's interesting that Rio Tinto's kept the name Rio Tinto. Mm. But Spain does not have a listed mining company. So we would be the only listed mining company in the country that fathered, if you like, modern mining as we know today.
Excellent. I mean, you touched on this point before that you're fully funded. I suppose often mining companies on AIM are often in search of financing. You have that financing. And that's obviously good. Great news for a mining executive like yourself, because you can concentrate on the job of building now. It's an interesting arrangement you have with the Oman Sovereign Wealth Fund here, in that you've got offtake agreements as part of this. You have a sort of convertible bond structure, which could give Oman, the Sovereign Wealth Fund, a stake above 30%. Can you just talk us through, you know, why you decided this was the best funding structure? And, you know, can you allay any fears that you have somehow, you know, potentially given a lot of the equity value away ahead of time?
We have two very strong drivers. One is we're very equity driven. We're absolutely focused on making the value of the asset get unlocked into the equity. And secondly, we're very debt averse. Junior mining companies often get themselves in trouble by putting complicated structures in place with private equity funds, for instance. So this is the simplest structure imaginable that gives us the best equity leverage. We have raised $120 million, of which $60 million we've drawn down in cash on a zero interest rate, zero coupon, with minimal security. And over a four-year period, when we build the mine, that the Omanis are able to convert that into equity at 50 pence a share, that will give them around 26% of the company. And then there's another $60 million tranche in three options. They, at their election, are able to convert at an average of about 85 pence a share. It's the other $60 million that goes in, and it'll take them up to over 30% of the company. So our view is this is like a major shareholder taking an equity placement in the company and becoming a shareholder alongside all other ordinary shareholders. They have no other rights other than to convert the note into the equity. You mentioned the offtake agreements. They're quite notional. What their issue was is that as the Middle East in general moves away from fossil fuels and looks for renewables and nuclear, the Omanis recognize that the ability to put their foot on some offtake would be desirable. but it's not a firm commitment. They just have the ability to match anything that we put in place. So we think that's more of a desirable thing from their perspective, but it certainly doesn't lock us into anything with them at any certain prices. In fact, the way we look at the offtake is that we've got some very good offtake in place. You know, even though the uranium price is $20 a pound, we've got offtakes in at $42 a pound. We are looking the second half of next year, that's halfway through the build, to put some more offtakes in place, and we expect it to be higher than the $42 a pound. So our business is relatively simple. We're fully funded, as you indicated, equity funded. There's no debt. We are going to build an asset that will make very good money at the current uranium price, but will make considerably more at the forward price. And if I can just share an example with you of a very successful junior mining company in London, known to many of your readers, would be Central Asia Metals. They also built a heap leach operation. They also generated very strong cash flow, paid it all back to shareholders, and were a phenomenal success. So if there's an example of what we look to that's possible, then it's certainly the Central Asia Metals is the kind of disciplined capital return money to shareholder approach that we think is very good.
Interesting. So that gives a hint, I suppose, because I mean that's really been an income stock, because they almost a victim of their own success with that mine in Kazakhstan, weren't they? That they almost couldn't find a project as good as that, and potentially dilute their sort of internal rates of return if they did so.
As you know, Alex, it's the ultimate dilemma for a junior company. You've got all the risk in a single asset company, and so companies often think about acquiring more. But if you've got an asset as good as ours is, you know, the Salamanca project is phenomenal. It will generate 100 to 150 million US dollar free cash flow at sort of moderate uranium prices. Well, Central Asia Metals were the same. Those assets are hard to find. So if you go and acquire something, often you, unless you've unlocked full value into your shares at that point, you're often better just sitting there distributing cash back to shareholders by way of dividend.
Right. So it's lots to unpack there. I mean, just to touch on what could be next, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves because, you know, the mine's not built yet. You still have sort of an exploration portfolio attached to the Salamanca mine. This often seems to be a theme of mining executives often saying that nothing is now priced in terms of exploration, that investors only value production when it comes and everything else is in for free. What's your exploration program looking like currently?
Just on the point you made about the value, I slightly disagree. I think there are two types of junior mining companies. The ones that have the ability to grow. So for in our case, we're starting with a sort of 10 to 14 year mine life, but we have a huge ground position with a quite astonishing geological endowment. So we believe that we can start off and maintain at any point in time a 10 year mine life. So if we produce 4.5 million pounds of uranium in 1 year, we expect to replace it every year. So we sustain that. And I've been involved with operations that have started with 8 years mine life, have been going 50 years later. And that's all to do with geological endowment and putting money back into the ground. Those companies tend to trade higher than an NPV and closer to a price earnings ratio, a PE ratio. It's a multiple type evaluation. Companies that have a slightly less obvious geological endowment struggle, and they're the ones that are constantly complaining, saying the market is not rewarding us for our exploration potential. Well, I think they have to demonstrate the potential is convertible and start showing converting in. So I think the market's quite savvy. It will say, look, we can see these measurable cash flows, discounted cash flow. If you want a higher rating, then you have to demonstrate the convertibility of this geological potential.
I suppose for mining investors, one of the difficulties with the uranium market in recent years is that on paper, it potentially looks like everything's perfect. The prices are only going to go up. You know, supply is being cut. Projects are being mothballed. But at the same time, you know, prices have been pretty stubbornly at that low $20 a pound mark. Can you just help explain a couple of things for me? I struggle to understand this. Why would European utilities, or for that matter, Chinese buyers, who, you know, often credited with being a lot more forward thinking in their metals buying habits, aren't suddenly locking in lots and lots of contracted supply now when prices are really at a floor? Why are they waiting, it would seem, for prices to rebound before doing deals?
two answers to that. One is they are trying to lock in.
Right.
So the utilities go out for the term contracts on things called RFQs, requests for quotation. And quite often we'll receive one saying, please sell us lots of uranium for the next 10 years at spot price. And obviously companies like us say no. So what you're seeing is a tension between the producer and the market, and it's just like a Mexican standoff. So there is no term contracting happening at the moment because the miners don't want to sell at these levels and the buyers want to buy at these very low levels. And so what we're seeing is in the spot market, you'll see more and more volume going through the spot market because there's nothing in the term. And that's what happened last time when the uranium price went for a very, very big run. The utilities ran down their inventories, their coverage, and suddenly one day the spot price started to run. Intermediaries got involved. The utilities decided, oh, we better come back into the market. And they did it en masse.
Right.
They came together. And so the clues to that are, and this is why quite a few funds are getting quite excited at the moment, we have quite a few intermediaries coming in and buying the spot market. We've just had Yellow Cake come around London, raise a very large amount of money, $170 million, to buy 8 million pounds of uranium. Next year, they're going to do another $100 million. Next year, after that, $100 million. So that's one intermediary. I know of a private buyer who's just bought $50 million worth of uranium off the spot market. And I've just come yesterday, I was talking to a fund in Australia that's got another $100 million to put into directly into the market. So what these funds are doing, they're front-running the institutions, front-running the utilities, and saying, we know this is an asymmetric bet. We don't know when it's going to change, but we know it is. So we're going to buy it ahead of you guys. And when you guys buy it, you're going to pay a lot more for it than you do. So we're sitting back looking at this and going, that's when we want to be pouring concrete as a miner, is when the intermediaries are buying the spot. And we know these utilities have got something like £700 million worth of uncovered requirements over the next 6 or 7 years. We know they've got to come back in the market. They'll be coming back into the market where the intermediaries are in there ahead of us. So we like that.
Sure.
That standoff, the longer it goes on, and the expression from the analysts is, the longer this standoff goes on, the more violent the reaction will be.
It just strikes me as so very short-sighted of these utility companies that wouldn't meet you halfway or wouldn't meet suppliers halfway, and that there is a Mexican standoff because, as you say, it's only going to lead to potentially sharper spikes, which is not really good for anyone.
Which is why people are positioning themselves. So we put quite a big volume of stock through the company of the last month or so, and these institutions are saying, we can see the same thing that you can see, Alex, and they're saying, well, we want to have a piece of Barclay because Barclay is going to dramatically benefit from this when it happens.
I just want to turn to the mine itself now. I mean, so we touched upon equity earlier, and you know, just on a look at the share price graph, it seems to be recovering a bit in the last month, but there has been this dip. You put out an RNS a couple of weeks ago saying that you didn't know of any publicly announced reason why this would be the case. That said, there does seem to be, at least in sort of Spanish media, and that there is some opposition to the project still, even though you have got some, you know, you've got government support. Can you just bring me up to speed on what the political situation is and how much civic opposition are you facing? And also, and I'm, you know, very careful here to not want to mischaracterize actually what the opposition is, but it seems to be some concern still about, you know, radioactivity levels, you know, that the mine is potentially going to raise, and issues over deforestation. Can you just address some of those issues, Paul?
Good. I'm really glad you raised that. So certainly, we do have quite a lot of opposition, and it falls into two groups. One is the sort of the local residents who have some concerns about any mine being built, and in this case, it's a uranium mine, so the specific concerns. And there's a broader concern, is we are a magnet for all the anti-nuclear groups across Europe. So we're very, very popular. They follow us, and they make lots of noise, and they generate all these headlines. So just very specifically, we put out an announcement the other day. There was some headlines on headlines saying that the Spanish government, the Portuguese government were going to paralyze the mine. Completely not true. There's no basis, obviously. It's just what happens is a green politician will bang the table and say the mine must be paralyzed. And suddenly this gets parlayed into headlines saying the Spanish government's going to close the mine. So we put out a very clear statement from both the Portuguese side and the Spanish side and the Castilian government saying, absolutely equivocally not the case, and that we are have the full support within the law and the local government.
Can I just ask, in terms of the Portuguese government, can you just briefly explain why the need that, you know, for their involvement?
Because the Greens went to them and made all sorts of claims about we were going to damage the Douro River and all sorts of things.
Runs
from Douro to Douro, runs into Portugal. I mean, as the minister pointed out to us, there's been mining on the board in the Iberian Peninsula for sort of something like 4,000 years, and there hasn't been any problem. On the more local issue, there's been uranium mining in this area for 40 years. And the stories of radioactive cows and all the rest of it are very, very good headlines, but they have no basis. So we have a study underway by the University of Salamanca that's identifying the benefits of mining in the area and the impact it's had on, beneficial in fact it's had on the agricultural community, the local community. So it can be properly articulated in a professional and academic manner. But much more specifically, much outweighing all of that by far, by a long way, is the fact that we're in a region that's lost 120,000 people over the last 5 years. We're talking about villages that have lost 75% of their population. Every year, there's 20 to 21,000 people leaving, mainly young people. And this depopulation is really, it is unquestionably the major issue in the region. So we come along, make an investment which will create 450 direct jobs, 2,500 indirect jobs, and rejuvenating the community. So not just creating the jobs, we're investing in Wi-Fi for the villages, new schools, playgrounds. We're giving priority to businesses, priority training to villages. These are factors that will rejuvenate the community. So, yes, the Greens will jump up and down and say we don't like uranium, we don't like nuclear. And, yes, there'll be all sorts of scare stories about radioactive cows and things. But the real game in town is there's 23,000 people have applied for the first 200 jobs. And that's what everybody's focused on. So I was in Salamanca recently. I presented our business case to 200 people. 200 of the business community came out, packed the Fonseca Cathedral, and they were there all night long, late on into the evening, saying, how can we help you? How can we make this investment happen? Because we need the business. We need the jobs. We need that side. So we're absolutely quite happy to entertain the Greens, entertain any concerns. They will help us make this the best mine in the world. And what I say to people is, we're already the higher standard than any other mining company in the world. These guys are going to make us even better so that they will be proud. Spain will be proud of this mine, proud of the investment, proud of the rejuvenation, and proud of the quality of the engineering that goes into it.
One of the points raised in a recent German documentary, I think they interviewed a local politician who was talking about deforestation. You have plans for replanting some of the trees.
It doesn't matter whether you build a primary school or a hospital, sure, or even a big building on the south side of the river here for Occupy the Financial Times. You have to knock down trees. In our case, we've knocked down some old oak trees, which were sort of fairly old and diseased. And we're planting, for every single tree that we knock down, we're planting 6 young, healthy new ones. So we're going to plant 30,000 trees. So we are, and we, in fact, we've just created an arboreal center where we're all the different types of species of vegetation we're going to recreate in the area. We're already husbanding those. And to give you some idea, is that there's a sort of perception of mining, dig a big hole in the ground, leave a hole. No. What we're doing is what's continuous mining. We open up a small area. We then mine that, process it. We line it. We rehabilitate it continuously. So there's a continuous rehabilitation. And the land we leave behind is in a better condition than the land when we started. And my personal experience, I started my career in Telford in Shropshire. And we took some old historical coal mining areas and we opened pit mine them, continuously rehabilitated them, and now it's a wonderful golf course, shopping center, housing estate, and you couldn't possibly see in this beautiful Shropshire countryside there'd ever been any mining there before. We are going to do exactly the same in Salamanca.
It's 2018. Populism and industry are sometimes, they're not easily matched bedfellows. Say, hypothetically, the new Spanish government, they are, you know, particularly opposed to nuclear energy. The fact that you're building a uranium mine, does that give you a better chance than the developer of a nuclear power station of being waved through?
Just two aspects to that. Germany has finally come out and admitted that Energiewende is an environmental disaster. When they closed nuclear in Germany, they now mine, in 2010, they now mine more lignite mining today than they did when they started Energiewende. And Emmanuel Macron came to power and said he's going to shut down nuclear. He's now done a somersault and said, quote, that if closing nuclear means I have to build more coal-fired power stations, reference to Germany, I'm not going to do it. Spain's exactly the same. Spain is going to meet its 2030 carbon targets because it has seven nuclear power plants providing baseload energy. Baseload, clean baseload energy plus renewables together is the future. That's why we've got 55 nuclear reactors being built around the world today. That's why Imperial College Grantham Institute keeps saying that 100% renewables is wishful thinking. So we think, despite the populism, despite all the noise, the science will outgrow this sort of populist trend that against nuclear. And in fact, the Finnish Green Group came out this morning, finally came out and admitted that they accept that they felt like a lot of other these NGOs in the families that we need nuclear. It's nuclear and renewables will give us a clean energy future. Closing nuclear and building gas-fired power stations, which is half the carbon, is going from zero carbon to adding carbon. So if you're talking about decarbonisation, you need nuclear. So I think the science will prevail, but you're talking about ideology, identity politics versus, and I'll put something bigger on the other side of the table, livelihoods. So everybody's very brave and tough when you talk about we're going to shut down nuclear, you don't like uranium mining, you don't like those kind of things. Those conversations get different when you go to Salamanca and you look at the empty school that's about to close, or you look at the people who've moved away, look at how many young people have left that area, and you say, do you know what? There's actually nothing wrong with this world-class mine that's operating to the very highest standards, because it's actually training, it's providing jobs, and it's going to rejuvenate a community. So, yes, lots of noise. The reality? Jobs.
Excellent. Just to finish as well, Paul, you quite recently bought around 2 million shares in the company. I mean, I don't want to go into your, you know, the line-by-line details of your own personal financial status, but, I mean, how big are you into the company?
Ever since I got involved with the company, I've just bought stock. So when I was first invited to join the company's manager director 2.5-3 years ago, I bought as much stock as I could on market, and every opportunity to convert options, I've written out a check. So I'm as long as anybody in this story.
Right. Excellent. Paul, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Alex. Really enjoyed that.
Cheers. And to listen to more audio from the IC, go to our website or search for us on Acast, iTunes, or wherever you normally get your podcasts.